The Japanese government does not see any tangible progress in North Korea's denuclearization.
Japan remains concerned of North Korean threat. It's Wednesday, August 29th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Glad to have you with us. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, cleaning Indonesia's plastics. New interest grows on Indian farms. A fruit may juice up a local economy. Crazy socks treat a genetic disorder. And spying on the history of spies. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Japan says North Korea continues to pose a serious threat to its security despite this year's diplomatic rapprochement and pledges of denuclearization. The Japanese Defense Ministry's annual white paper on security was approved by the cabinet of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and continues to express alarm over China's rising budget, military modernization, and assertiveness in the region. Defense Minister Itsunori Onodera said North Korea possesses a few hundred Rodong missiles capable of hitting Japanese territory. He said they have conducted nuclear and missile tests and have progressed with their programs and have hundreds of missiles capable of reaching Japan. Some of the North's missile launches last year traversed Japanese airspace. The paper warned Pyongyang has increased the range, accuracy, and versatility of its missiles and diversified its launch sites and methods in recent years. Yoichiro Sato is a professor of international strategic studies at Japan's Ritsumeikan Asia Pacific University. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty.
Despite meeting between Trump and Kim Jong-un and the agreement that came out of it, in June, the Japanese government does not see any tangible progress in North Korea's denuclearization since then. In addition to that, during the last few days, Japanese national was held in North Korea, and the government took a great effort to make his release happen, which just happened recently. The government, as soon as this release was completed, the government issued its defense white paper in the cabinet meeting today on August 28, in which this North Korean threat was already written in the statement. But there seems to be the timing is not just coincidence, and the government likely waited the publication of this white paper until the hostage release was completed.
What is Japan doing to protect itself against this threat?
Well, Japan has agreed with the U.S. to deploy ground-based Aegis system in order to be able to defend major cities against the North Korean nuclear missiles. There are indications that North Korea continues to develop nuclear weapons and also continue to work on improving its missile capabilities. Unless North Korea start implementing in details what was agreed in June summit meeting between the U.S. and North Korea, Japan is not likely to alter its perception of threats from North Korea.
This was an all-around white paper defense analysis of the threats. North Korea is one, but China is another, isn't it?
Yes, China is also addressed as a major concern for Japan, especially the expansion of its maritime activities. China has set up base in Djibouti, where the Japanese and Americans are also operating overseas military base. And in addition to that, China's so-called Belt and Road Initiative is seen not only as an economic move, but more of a strategic move by China, through which China is developing infrastructure possibly to be used by the Chinese naval forces.
Meanwhile, a Japanese man held for a month on unspecified charges was released by North Korea and flown to Beijing before returning home. North Korea said it released Tomoyuki Sugimoto on humanitarian grounds. He's reportedly a videographer and may have been detained for filming a military facility while with a tour group near the western port city of Nampo. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. 14 jailed Cambodian opposition activists freed. Japan says North Korea still poses dire threat to its security. China says sanctions and criticism won't help settle Rohingya issue. China defends New Silk Road against debt complaints. Extreme Vespa enthusiasts rev up at Indonesian festival. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also stop by the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Indonesia produces an estimated 1.3 million tons of plastic every day, much of which ends up in the oceans, clogging the ecosystem and killing wildlife. Last year, the country pledged to cut the amount it throws into the seas by 70% by the year 2025. As Jack Hewson reports, the sea itself could help to solve the problem.
Here on Pulau Tidung, 40 kilometers off of Jakarta's north coast, farmers are cultivating seaweed. With year-round sunshine and 54,000 kilometers of coastline, Indonesia is the second biggest producer of seaweed in the world.
The process starts with growing the seeds. That takes about a month. Harvesting occurs 40 days later. We just need a market.
One young businessman sees a market for Dahlan in using seaweed for Indonesia to meet its goal of cutting plastic marine waste by 70% by 2025. David Christian is the CEO of EvoWare, which makes edible bioplastics out of seaweed sourced from local farmers.
For the packagings, like we make it 100% from seaweed, so we take the seaweed directly from the farmers with the cooperatives that we're working. We just like overwhelmed with the inquiries, so that's why we need to move quick to do the mass productions.
Indonesia is now the world's second largest producer of plastic waste. And EvoWare is primarily hoping to replace single-use small plastic sachets that are too small to recycle. But anti-plastics activists say Indonesian consumers need to be educated to embrace alternative materials.
Yeah, the biggest obstacle to deal or to treat the plastic problem is because lack of knowledge. There is no proper education about how the plastic degrade and then contaminate the environment.
Approximately 1.3 million tons of plastic is produced across Indonesia every day. But if consumers can be persuaded to use bioplastics, then a huge new market is waiting to be developed, and one that could enrich Indonesia's seaweed farmers. Jack Hewson for VOA News, Pulau Tidung, Indonesia.
Happening now in Asia, Chinese officials are defending Beijing's initiative to build a new Silk Road of railways and other infrastructure across Asia against complaints it leaves host countries with too much debt after Malaysia canceled two high-profile projects. The officials say developing countries need the assets. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're midway through our week. We're glad you're with us on VOA Asia. For decades, India has seen a one-way migration from the countryside into towns for jobs as farmers battle water shortages, degraded soils, low crop prices, and the effects of climate change. But reversing the tide, some people are returning to family farms, hoping to introduce modern techniques to address these challenges and boost agricultural incomes. Anjana Pasricha met some of the New Age farmers at a center run in collaboration with the Indian and Israeli governments that teaches protected farming in Karnal in northern India's Haryana state.
Engineering graduate Mishank Bhatia turned to farming after failing to find a suitable job. But the 23-year-old wants to tread a different path from his father, who cultivates rice and wheat. He plans to modernize the family farm by growing vegetables and flowers in a controlled environment in a net house.
Temperature will be maintained, air will be filtered, there will be fewer chances of diseases, and we will do drip irrigation to conserve water.
Bhatia is learning protected cultivation at the Indo-Israeli Center of Excellence for Vegetables at Gharonda in Karnal district, along with a group that includes some unlikely candidates, a former stockbroker, a retired senior government official, and a well-paid corporate executive. Like tens of thousands, these men had left family farms for better opportunities in cities, but they are returning as they see potential in transforming conventional farms. They pay careful attention as they learn how seedlings nurtured in high-technology greenhouses with controlled temperatures and provisions for micro-irrigation save labor costs and water, boost productivity, and are environmentally sustainable.
The biggest benefit is farmers will not incur losses due to the vagaries of nature, such as storms, heavy rain, extreme heat, or cold. Insects and pests will not come in controlled conditions. He can grow fruits and vegetables in the off-season for better profit.
Most farmers in India prefer to plant wheat and rice that the government buys at fixed prices. But Jasbir Singh, who took early retirement from a government job, is confident that a $35,000 investment will pay off quickly.
Wheat and rice is going to only give me a specific income. And that is, in India at present, is about 50,000 rupees profit per year per acre. Whereas vegetables, the sky is the limit. And it's basically a one-time investment. And out of which 50% is subsidized, given by government.
That is why former stockbroker Vikram Bhalla plans to build a high-technology nursery on a portion of his 121-hectare farm in eastern India.
Not only will we be sure of our production, which is a very big plus in agriculture. So it will be more like running a factory where you know you have an input, and if you do all the correct procedures, we'll have a definite output.
The hope is that as protected cultivation gains ground, it will revive interest in agriculture. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Karnal.
Coming up, can profits blossom from a new fruit? You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia. Cambodia has released 14 members of the country's dissolved opposition party in the wake of a controversial election that extended Prime Minister Hun Sen's three-decade grip on power. The group was convicted for insurrection after taking part in a 2014 street protest that turned violent. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the trade rift between the United States and China is taking on new dimensions, with Washington scrutinizing the flow of technology to Chinese industries. Analysts say that China may be in for both economic and political problems if the United States cuts off the supply of technologies that are essential for the survival of major Chinese companies. Washington's measures, like imposing heavy duties on a wide range of Chinese exports, is already having a serious impact on China's fixed asset investments in areas like infrastructure projects and manufacturing plants. Meanwhile, a flowering fruit tries to sweeten a local economy while expanding trade tariffs ripple through new sectors of the economy in today's edition of VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
Farmers in India's northeastern state of Nagaland are growing the country's first dragon fruit. The exotic-looking pink fruit is typically imported from Southeast Asian countries, but at Dream Dragon Fruit Farm, farmers wanted to harness the optimal conditions. Lucy Thomas is a farm owner.
We were like, why not grow it ourselves? when the climate is suitable, we have the land, everything. So we started off, and then started as a hobby, we made it commercial.
In an effort to revitalize the economy, former chief of state T.R. Zeliang had advocated for the cultivation of dragon fruits because of its commercial potential and productive yield. Lucy Thomas.
The dragon fruit will only flower when it rains. So when the monsoon starts from May, it'll start budding. Mm-hmm. And from there, it'll start budding. And from June, you'll get your first harvest. And it will go on. It will go on till November.
Dream Dragon Fruit Farm is currently the only dragon fruit farm in the state. At public hearings last week in Washington, D.C., businessmen spoke out about the impact of the U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods. Among the concerns cited were job losses, higher costs, and having to pass on those higher costs to consumers. The U.S. energy sector and shipping industries are among those likely to take a hit. The Chinese market has become increasingly important for U.S. liquefied natural gas companies. Kent Moores is the executive chairman of Energy Capital Research Group.
Right now, China accounts for about 15% of all the LNG the United States is exporting. But that figure was expected to rise significantly by the time we got to 2020 and beyond. If we still have this difficulty at this point next year, everybody's going to have to be revising their export contract estimates.
New U.S. tariffs on $16 billion worth of Chinese goods went into effect last week, and China shot right back with equal tariffs on American products. Another round of tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods is currently being considered. Unlike previous rounds of U.S. tariffs, which sought to shield consumers by targeting Chinese industrial machinery, electronic components, and other intermediate goods, thousands of consumer products could be directly hit with tariffs this time. As many of these goods move by sea, the shipping industry is also likely to be impacted. Ravi Ramamurthy is the director for the Center of Emerging Markets at Northeastern University.
If the volume of tariffs, a volume of products subject to tariffs, goes up both in the U.S. and in China, then it would have a material effect on the shipping industry. Shipping industry is a very high fixed cost business. When there's a small change in the volume, you can have a very large movement in prices.
China and the United States concluded tariff talks last week without any major breakthroughs. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. Japan says North Korea continues to pose a serious and imminent threat to its national security, despite the regime's recent flurry of diplomatic overtures to the outside world. The assessment was the conclusion of Japan's annual defense policy paper, published Tuesday. Published daily are all the big stories on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, John Cronin has never been one to let disability hold him back. The 22-year-old from Long Island, New York, was born with Down syndrome, a genetic disorder that causes developmental and intellectual delays. Motivated by his family's love and encouragement, Cronin teamed up with his father 18 months ago to open a business. But not just any business. John's Crazy Socks sells, well, you guessed it, socks. And as VOA's Faiza El-Masri reports, it's a business worth $4 million. Worth $1 million for her narration is Faith Lapidus.
Are you a Down syndrome superhero?
After graduating from high school, John Cronin wanted nothing more than to go into business with his dad, Mark.
You're a talented guy.
Yes, I am.
The father-son duo brainstormed and decided to go forward with the one thing John loves most, socks.
Oh, you designed these?
I just designed those.
You designed
this one.
That one? You designed that one?
Yeah, I like that too. I would sell crazy socks. Why socks? Because it's fun, it's colorful, I like to be creative, and I want to do wonderful things here. Let me be me.
Since launching John's Crazy Socks, father and son have been, well, crazy busy. While John, the face of the company's videos and promotions, puts orders together, Mark takes care of the technical aspects of the business, such as accounting, managing inventory, and staffing.
We've been able to create 35 jobs. 18 of those are held by people with differing abilities. We've raised over $135,000 for our charity partners.
John and Mark try to make each sock purchase personal. They make in-person deliveries to homes in the Long Island area. But for those who live farther, John does something special. He places a personal note inside each box.
What's our mission?
Our mission is pray happiness.
Our customers are happy, right? We have over 10,000 online reviews. 96% of those are five-star reviews. And we've done a lot of work, a lot of business. We've shipped over 115,000 orders and earned over $4 million in revenue.
John's Crazy Socks doesn't only spread happiness through their socks. The company also spreads happiness to those in need. 5% of John's profits go to the Special Olympics, and the company also donates to the National Down Syndrome Society and the Association for Children with Down Syndrome. That makes these founders feel crazy happy, which motivates them to help others feel the same. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
These are strange and confusing times in Washington. Political operatives meeting with Russian lawyers, a White House at odds with its own intelligence community. But the Washington intrigue appears to be driving renewed interest in the secretive world of spies. And that's just fine with the new director of Washington's International Spy Museum. Reporter Ardita Dunalari paid a quick visit to the Spy Museum to speak to a former spy who is now the Spy Museum's director.
In spite of the political intrigue that plays out every day just a few blocks away, the Spy Museum prefers to keep its nose out of it. Its new director says the museum deals in facts and objective information, and adds he'd rather leave the political rhetoric to the pundits and former intelligence officials.
They have a right when they leave the government to speak out. Well, we don't focus on the current events. Our objective is to inform the public through a historical lens. We contextualize at the museum, we contextualize current events through history.
Colonel Chris Costa is more interested in educating an increasingly curious public about the inner workings of spycraft, something he knows firsthand after 34 years as a counterintelligence expert for the U.S. Army. He admits his new role as the Spy Museum's executive director took some getting used to.
But then it became very cathartic. The opportunity that I have, a tremendous opportunity, to tell my story responsibly, to engage with the public.
Walking through the exhibits, the director is reminded of past covert operations and one faux pas involving ice cream.
Literally, the first time I wore a disguise, I wore a mustache. And I put that mustache on, and I was compelled, and I won't get into the details, but I was compelled to eat an ice cream cone. Have you ever worn a disguise, and then have you ever worn a mustache while you ate an ice cream cone? Horrified that it will fall off, you know, in mid-stride as you're eating that ice cream cone.
While Costa's days of living dangerously may be behind him, he takes his new role very seriously, representing the work of agents who toil in the shadows to protect their country.
It's a no-fail proposition. I have to be the one out there that represents those people that can't talk about their work to inform the public.
Public interest in spycraft and the role it has played in history has grown since the museum first opened in 2002. The museum plans to move to a new building next year with state-of-the-art exhibits. Costa says the public can expect to see more gadgets and hear more stories to satisfy their curiosity about the secretive and exciting world of espionage. Ardita Dunelari, VOA News, Washington.
If you find yourself here in Washington, stop by the Spy Museum, a fascinating part of your visit, no doubt. You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find us on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can also download us as a podcast. And of course, you can stream us. We're on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. We're also on the radio. You can hear us in Thailand. U Radio of Hatay University, FM 101.25 at Hatay University. We thank everyone there who's tuned in to our program today and wherever you may be listening. Our program's brought to you by some really great people, like director Tracy Carter, engineer Kelvin Fowler, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Enjoy your day.